From the Land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 12th day of May, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. He'll help us explore this morning's USDA report as well. We'll also hear again from Gary Schnittke. He's traveling in the western part of Mato Grosso to one of the largest farms in the world. And then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
July corn for the day settled at 586 and a quarter, up 4 cents. December, that's the new crop at 508 and three quarters, down 5. July soybeans at 1390, 15 and a half lower. And November beans at 1223 and three quarters, down 24 and a quarter. And the soft red winter wheat in the July up 7 and three quarters of a cent at 635. Mike Zuzulo, GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, joins us on this USDA report day, the first look at the new crop corn and soybeans and first production numbers really from USDA for the new crop wheat as well. Tell me what you found in the marketplace.
I think we're getting there when it comes to the wheat coming in and supporting the markets. And that's really what this report was all about to me, Todd. We knew that the USDA was going to give us probably top end yields in new crop corn and new crop beans. And they didn't disappoint with 52 bushel beans and 181 and a half on corn. And so that really swelled the new crop carryover. But we'd already traded a lot of that in terms of the big discount in new crop futures versus the old crop. And so the question for me going into the report was, okay, hard red wheat, corn, and beans are still carrying an inversion where the front end price is premium to the back end price. We're trying to kill demand, which we were. We're killing it badly on the export front. But we are also trying to price in a bigger supply down the road. And so the question is, going into the report, is soft red wheat the only one that was back at a carrying charge market? Is it the anomaly, or do the other three need to fall and reverse that spread? And I think the report today would suggest that soft red wheat has a chance to regain that inversion thanks to the hard red wheat, because the USDA did cut that all wheat yield, which is, again, to me, an absolute necessity to kind of wake up the trade about the tighter feed grain numbers. And one last thing to kind of bleed into the report or blend into the report is the Bloomberg News came out with a really good article this morning that really matched up with what we're talking about right now by saying that, yeah, China's canceling U.S. corn because of some cheaper South American prices, but it's also because they're finding wheat so much better to buy, especially in some key areas that they can bring wheat in so cheap. So wheat really is the key to unlock the door to holding these price levels and not letting any more price erosion, especially in the new crop prices.
Yeah, so USDA giving us some interesting figures, 2.222 billion bushels for the carryout. I think that's probably on the high end of what the trade was expecting. A 480 season's cash price, 335 million bushels their carryout for soybeans with a 1210 season's average cash price. Those both for the new crop. What'd you make of those sets of numbers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the USDA did something very, very interesting in the export numbers for 22 versus 23, and makes me wonder whether we're not going to see the funds maybe turn into more of a friendly buy corn, sell bean type mindset, because they took soybean exports from 2.015 this current marketing year down to 1.975, did the exact opposite in the corn. They went from 1.775 current marketing year up to 2.1 billion. And so they're saying we're going to grow in corn exports this marketing year. And even with that growth, they're still saying we're going to have a 2.2 billion bushel corn crop. I would say one last thing, based upon probably what you're hearing, but especially I can say from what I'm hearing from clients from central Kansas all the way to Champaign right now, is they're not super happy with emergence in a good chunk of that land. And so the 181 and a half and 52 may be the top end, the very high end of the yield estimates from USDA this year. especially as we get towards the later part of the year, and especially if we start to see these emergence numbers on the Monday afternoon crop reports show us some states that are having some difficulties.
If those numbers are big enough and replant is big enough, we may see USDA WASD change the June or July figures, one of the two. But more likely, that'll hold off until we get to the actual crop production report, which comes from USDA NAS as opposed to the World Ag Outlook Board in the month of August. Bottom line, did things change enough today for you to change your advice to producers?
Yes, they did. Last month, after the WASD numbers came out, I wrote, is 625, 640 front end corn justified? And I said, yes. Today I said, no, it's not, unless the wheat comes in and supports us here. And this is where I think the new crop is the one that has the discount to it. So old crop versus new crop, if you're sitting on old crop supplies, it may be an idea after, especially we trade next week and see what these spreads do, the July D spread especially, see whether it may not be a good idea to let go of old crop and replace that ownership in the new crop, because we're already at 480 in terms of cash price for fall delivery, and that's right where the USDA is on their average cash price. So I think and the wheat is a dollar plus below where USDA is at their $8 cash price today. So I'm in the mindset that the new crop has the discount, the old crop has the premium in corn and beans, and that's something that's going to have to work itself out.
Thank you much, sir.
Thank you.
That is Mike Zuzulo. He's with GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Well, if you've been listening, you know that the Farm Dog team is in Brazil and has been for a couple of weeks now. Gary Schnittke talked to me earlier today, ag economist from the U of I, from the western part of Mato Grosso. That's the largest soybean-producing state in the nation. He is at one of the five largest farms in the state, the Schaefer Farms. I asked him to tell me a little bit about them and his visit with that particular farming operation.
He farms 160,000 hectares, which multiply that by 2.47 and you got acres. So most of the people here in Mato Grosso, their farm began in 1986 and it was started by his father. And they grew after moving from southern Brazil up to here. Again, he has 160,000 hectares. And he points to a training that he received from Rabobank in 2005 that changed his farm operations. And that made him more businesslike, added business structure and governance structure to his operation, and largely led to the expansion. So he really credits that program for making a switch in his business operations and leading to the size he is today. I would add to that he was building in an area where there was nothing. So land was much less expensive than what it is in the United States. So the capital requirements were much less as he was building his farm operation. And in fact, he's looking elsewhere because he thinks the land costs have gotten too high. We talked and he mentioned to me that he thinks he's right, that in the U.S., most of the return goes to the landowner. And that hasn't been the case here in Brazil as of yet. So, but that likely will, rents and land prices will likely continue there.
What else did you find of interest on the Schaefer farm?
So he is also really big in regenerative agriculture and in biologicals. He is in partnership with Syngenta and he on his farm is experimenting and producing biologicals. He's collecting bacteria and other items from his farms, has a lab on his farm, reproducing those and regenerating or multiplying those bacteria. And it's been experimenting with ways of using those rather than other inputs. And we got to see that operation. And he's using that to get his insecticide sprays, as well as using that to reduce his nitrogen fertilizer. He actually has a he has 160,000 hectares in Mato Grosso. All of that is first crop soybeans, and much of it later on is second crop cotton. So, and then he shortens up the soybean variety so he can plant cotton earlier. So he suffers. He takes a little bit loss on the cotton or soybeans to get more on the cotton.
Interesting. I have a series of follow-ups. I want to go back to Rabobank very quickly. Did he take, because that was so many decades ago, did he take that training there in Brazil or did he go to the Netherlands for it? And what was it about the training that really prompted him to be able to grow so much?
He took that training here in Brazil, but at that point in time, he was buying or borrowing money from Rabobank. My guess is Rabobank targeted a number of operations that they thought were going to be growing operations in the future and got them in, gave them training. And a lot of that was on financial statements. And in fact, he showed me his financial statements on his iPhone, complete with projections for next year. So, so it's the that was key, and just he just said being more businesslike was what really stuck with him.
And then the cooperation he has with Syngenta. What did he tell you about the nitrogen experiments he's been doing and how successful they are, and does he have corn that he's trying to use them with as well, or is that
he's using them on cotton? And I didn't quite understand what was all going on there. So
yeah, I wondered. It seemed like it might be pretty deep in the weeds.
Yeah.
The biologicals he's harvesting simply there, and you use the word regenerative in to talk about the farm. I can't imagine what we think about as regenerative, but maybe you can explain this to me. Here in the United States, which usually is on very small acreage, is that the kind of regenerative agriculture, or are they redefining this?
Well, who's redefining it is a good question. Good question. But he is looking for things that he can use on his whole of his acres, and more or less, he is trying to improve his soil health, his organic matter in his soil, and perhaps get into the carbon markets, and essentially switch away from chemical insecticides and fertilizer to biologicals. In any one of those switches, he will look at the ROI on it. This isn't small acreage sort of thing. He has a factory, or I guess you would call a factory, a place where they regenerate or create the bacteria and other items in bulk, and a laboratory where they look at things and then try new things. So yeah.
Then next week, let's move on. You, Nick Paulson, and
Eric and Joanna. So it'll be Joanna Calusi, Nick Paulson, Eric Morgan, and myself will do a webinar on Thursday. So yeah, we'll talk about our experiences. We'll talk about the land reserve that is there, their logistics issues. I will talk about some of their management practices that they put in place, and talk about those issues. When you look at Brazil, you got to remember that this is or Mato Grosso in particular, it's basically the size of the Midwest that didn't have a road or production in it during the 1980s, and they expanded from that point to where they are today. So that's important context to keep in mind.
And will you also take up what that competitiveness means to the United States going forward?
Well, you know, as we look at their costs are roughly similar to ours with a lot less land costs. But those land costs have been rising over time. But you don't, I don't see Brazil slowing down its growth, particularly if we have soybean prices at $13 to $14 an acre. You'll see growth. If you get down to 10, 11, you won't see as much. But they have a great deal of pasture that can be converted to cropland. Not, it's probably not as productive as what they have now, but still, we've heard estimates of 2 times the acres can still be converted to cropland.
It should be a good webinar. Thank you. I look forward to hosting it and being there with you on Thursday of next week. And people can sign up online now at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Look under the webinar section or at willag.org and scroll down into the schedule, and you'll see that highlighted in red for next week on the 18th. Thank you, Gary. Gary Schnuke is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. He's been traveling for the last 12 days in Brazil. We'll hear once more from him on Monday. He'll be back in the United States by then. And then the webinar, of course, is on Thursday of next week. You can sign up for that at the Farm Doc Daily website, again, or willag.org. On our website, you'll find a playlist with all of these audio interviews, including video on top of them from YouTube. And there is also a link to a photo gallery from the visit to Brazil. Well, let's check the weather forecast on this Friday with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Happy graduation weekend to you. Well, happy graduation weekend to everybody. Eric, I'm so happy. I've got two, and I said something about this yesterday, but I have two that are graduating with their master's degrees from the University of Illinois this weekend. Megan will walk today with an MBA from the Geese College. And Jared will walk on Sunday, and he's getting his master's degree in recreational management. I'm so proud to have two more graduates from the University of Illinois, and I know you have to be excited this time of year anyway. Still, even though you're with Nutrien Ag Solutions based on your years of service at the U of I. Thank you for those, by the way.
Yeah. I do miss this time of year. It's one of those times where when I was a professor and we would, you know, run graduation, you really got to see the fruit of all that labor, right? Those kids just, you know, doing the thing that they needed to do to get onto the next level. And, you know, it's bittersweet, but boy, it's great. And what a legacy this university has. And I'm so thankful to be a part of it.
Indeed, it does. We better talk about the weather forecast, too. Can you recap the rainfall over the last week for me?
Yeah, the rainfall the last week. Here's the key thing to think about, all right? So, because as we think forward, this is something we need to be seeing here for the next 6 weeks. What we had was called Southwest Flow. That's where the jet stream was going from California straight across Illinois, eventually ended up somewhere almost in New England. And what's important about that in spring is that that opens up the Gulf of Mexico and just transports a lot of moisture north. In fact, you can feel it today. It's very humid outside today. That's all that juicy air. Well, this past week, it initiated a lot of thunderstorms. In fact, you know, earlier in the week, we had an event that came through parts of central Illinois. I mean, it really hit the Springfield area hard, all the way down from like a line from Springfield straight to central Kentucky of 4 to 8 inches of rain. Well, over here we had good rains as well. And it actually rained in the harder winter wheat belt. It rained in parts of Nebraska that needed it. We had rain in Texas. And this is just one of those weeks where you look back and you see more holes filled in than you see left open. We've actually shrunk the area that still has those significant soil moisture deficits. And I don't know about you, Todd, but my sump pump's been running all week. So that tells me there is at least moisture getting down somewhere here in Illinois. So this is what we needed. Now, it doesn't set us up for long, right? This will carry us forward, the moisture that came through. But we need to continue to see more storms. And thankfully, this weekend, we do have another shot at getting that in. Now, I do know some of the crops still need to get planted. And once we get into next week, we'll start to see some drier weather coming in. But this was a week where we were trying to push the drought monitor backwards, and that's good. I like to see that.
Well, what is next in the month of May, maybe out into June as well?
Well, that time period is an important transition time period. That's where we go from our spring setup to our summer setup. Now, a moment ago, I told you I love Southwest Flow in the jet stream. When you and I start talking in June, I'm going to switch that whole narrative. I'm going to tell you how much I love Northwest jet stream flow. And the reason is when it comes out of the Northwest, it initiates storms that ride from the Northwest to the Southeast. Now, they can be strong. They can produce those squall lines, but they deliver rain. The thing I'm thinking about right now is that some of the new data that's out, some of the longer-term outlooks suggest that we don't have anything setting up early that's going to give us extended time periods of drier weather going forward. Now, we'll end up getting a drier week in there, but there's nothing right now that I see that's going to cause major problems early, especially right here in the heart of the Corn Belt. So all of this is quite positive as we look forward here in the near term. And we'll just need to keep our eye out week to week to see how the moisture does come through.
El Nino and the forecast, what difference does it make?
It makes a huge difference for us in summer. And here's the reason why. El Ninos tend to give us a lot of northwest flow, like we just talked about. So if we get that flow out of the northwest, we initiate more storms. There's juice in the atmosphere to really produce the rain, and a lot of us are happy. So yesterday, the Climate Prediction Center just released their latest outlook for El Nino, and they ratcheted up the June, July, August probability of having El Nino to now be 89%. And for the rest of the year, all the way through this winter even, they've got those probabilities above 90%, which means we're going to be in an El Nino pattern. There's quite a lot of confidence in that. And to be honest with you, Todd, it's here right now. We're already getting the El Nino symptoms in the atmosphere. You probably heard about all the heat that's going into the Pacific Northwest this weekend and early next week. That typically happens during El Nino years. And unfortunately, I mean, this is going to be a little tough out west. Think about California. They still have about 80% of the snowpack they built up this winter. There are some places in the Sierra Nevada mountains that have over 100 inches of liquid in the snowpack. And now we're going to pack 90-degree heat into the valley. That's going to start to melt some of that snow. There's going to be major flooding issues in the west while the northwest takes on all the heat. That might be something we see a lot this summer, the northwest taking on the heat because of El Nino.
Turn your attention to South America. The FarmDoc team has been touring there for the past 12 days. I've seen the pictures. Folks can see them up on our website at willag.org or look at the YouTube playlist. Either one, you'll find photos of both the corn and the soybean crop. They look fantastic there. What are weather conditions like?
Well, I take my own pictures, but from home, I just go out and I look at all of the satellite imagery of that area. And I'll tell you something, Todd, the crop down there from space right now has nearly the highest NDVI values for this time of year, looking back over the last 20 years. And so the crop looks good, but the monsoon shutdown. Now, we typically expect that in the month of May. This will not negatively impact any of the crop that is already in grain filling going forward. But any of the crop that was planted a little bit later, this could take the top end off of the yield. But I don't think it's going to be something that's going to make a big shockwave. At least my current opinion of it is that just because of the time of year it is. They start harvesting this crop in another, 30 days or so. They start doing that in June. So we'll watch carefully to see how the end of this season shakes down there.
Hey, thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
That's Eric Snodgrass with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Stay with us here on Illinois Public Media. Commodity Week is coming up next.